Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that's going stateside. My name's Corey Hazelhurst and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
And with us, very excitingly, is Transatlantic. We're talking to someone in a nuclear bunker across in the States. It's Patrick Cook. Hello, Patrick.
Hello, Steve and Corey. How are we today?
Pretty good. Well, considering that we've got a snap election and I'm facing 5 weeks of door knocking in the cold of Birmingham, could be worse.
Yeah. Welcome to late fall, early December elections. We have them every 2 years for generals, so I feel your pain.
Yeah, although usually not this close to Christmas. Yeah, this is October 74 is probably our last one. And then we had the reassuring figure of Harold Wilson to make everything better. Patrick, before we talk about American politics, because apparently there's some quite big news in American politics that isn't to do with Brexit, which we appear to have missed.
I can't understand. Everything's to do with Brexit, isn't it?
You would think. Before we go on, do you want to introduce yourself and just say a little bit about where you're coming from?
Well, I'm Patrick Cook. I worked in Democratic politics for 4 years right out of college in Oregon, running state races for Democrats. I now left politics because I wanted to have quality of life. And now work in IT, but stay pretty current with it as just a general love. And I didn't want to ruin love with work because I'd get burnt out like I did for 4 years. I'm a registered Dem, live in New York now. I'm very interested to see how Brexit covers over here and how you guys are covering impeachment, because it's very interesting to see it from like a kind of objective view. And I'm excited to help you understand the crazy thing that is American politics.
Yeah, that would be nice. I mean, I don't feel objective view of impeachment might be hard over here because Donald Trump is not very popular over here.
No, he's not popular at all.
But I'm really looking forward to talking about it. And also, as you say, fall elections every year. Hopefully we won't have a winter election for another 45 years. But there will be a presidential race this time next year. So let's think about the state of American politics going into that. What is the state of impeachment proceedings into Donald Trump? Kind of, if we're trying to explain it to someone in Britain who is obsessed with Brexit and has maybe not been following the Trump news, what should they know?
As you're probably aware, there's two houses in our Congress. There's the House of Representatives, which is controlled by Democrats, and the Senate, which is controlled by the Republicans. The Democratic House is a lot more liberal than it probably was when he last controlled it in, say, 2006, when they had a majority. The problem is that Trump is super unpopular among Democrats, incredibly unpopular. And the other thing that plays a lot, the Democrats represent very Democratic states that did not vote for him and most likely didn't vote for him in the presidential election. But our wonderful Electoral College still elected him. And the Senate is very much more solidly conservative with a very, very pro-Trump Republican Party. Most Republicans are a pack, for lack of a better term, so they're always going to support the president, whether they agree with him on any issue. It's a very much more cohesive pack than the Democrats are. It's also showing kind of the limits of executive power in our free branch system. There's never been a successful impeachment in U.S. history. The most successful one is Clinton, but he was never technically impeached. He was convicted in Congress, but was never sentenced in the Senate. And Nixon's the only other one, and he jumped off the bus before it crashed, for lack of a better term.
Yeah. Had there been any impeachment votes into Nixon, or did he just resign?
It sounds like, I was talking about this with somebody today, it sounds like that was the gold standard of where they had the impeachment inquiry. They set up the ones, and it was legislated through, but I don't think it ever came to a vote. I will probably have to get back to you, but I'm generally thinking he jumped off pretty early. I don't think there was a vote.
The dichotomy that you mentioned of the fact that it's quite a liberal House of Representatives, but the Senate is more conservative, I suppose, was maybe a factor in Nancy Pelosi's thinking to try and delay impeachment until the Ukrainian business came out, because there was talk of her maybe trying to launch impeachment proceedings into other of Trump's crimes or misdemeanors, call them what you will. But then as soon as the news came out about the phone call with the Ukrainian president about some sort of quid pro quo of look into Joe Biden and in return we'll give you a nice White House meeting, it took quite a while for that to happen, didn't it? And I suppose, was it almost looking for a slam dunk? Is that the American sporting metaphor of choice?
That's a perfect one to use.
That's good. I usually use cricket metaphors, so basketballs.
Yeah, I actually understand the American metaphors.
It seemed like the emolument clause was what they thought they could get him on. And do you guys understand what the emolument clause is of the U.S. Constitution?
I believe it's essentially saying that the president can't use his position to basically further his own, line his own pockets or that kind of thing, I think.
Yes, the best example to use is that basically Jimmy Carter had to sell his family's peanut farm that had been in his family for a century before he took office because he possibly could have used it for his own private benefit. And they also require by law, and I'm doing this in air quotes, require by law to have any business stuff in what's called a blind trust. So you have, if you own shares in a company or in the case of majority owner of it, like a CEO, and you have majority shares, you're supposed to put it to a trustee that doesn't touch it and doesn't talk to you until after you're finished your term in office. Again, it's all kind of slightly hasn't been tested because everybody's really played by the rules, for lack of a better term. So similar to your wonderful house's rules, it's really dependent on everybody playing by the rules, but hasn't really been tested if someone decides to do what they want.
Trump's money is in a blind trust run by his children, isn't it? Which I suppose is fine. Or it would be fine if it was Eric, maybe.
Yeah, but given I don't think there's really that much blindness in that trust, I think it's safe to say that alone would probably be worth a little bit of investigation.
And it's interesting you talk about the unwritten norms, I suppose, that Trump's willing to push, which, as you say, is more, I suppose, you often think of it as being a British phenomenon, given our wonderfully unwritten constitution. And just thinking about Trump himself, I don't know if he's ever on the rails, but you've got his press secretary talking about John Kelly, who was his chief of staff. And the brief dark quote was, it was like something from North Korea, wasn't it? It was something...
Yeah, he couldn't handle... John Kelly couldn't handle Donald Trump's genius or something along to those kind of lines.
Yeah,
I always say the best, if you want to see kind of generally how our system works in the best way, and is to watch West Wing, Veep, and House of Cards, because that kind of generally gives you the fact that there is, you know, if the press secretary is supposed to be, is not a political for one, is paid for by out of government money, is supposed to be kind of has some sense of decorum and generally be the person that gets their message across, but also keeps themselves away from political things. That's what the press secretary of the presidential campaign or the communications director, which is generally slightly more political than the press secretary. But he's using it as pushing as far as he can go, and then he'll step back because he can kind of do what he wants with it. It's all based on executive by how they would decide to run the executive branch, which is more by and large, not really governed by congressional legislation. They kind of do their own thing. And by the way, the separations of powers, they're not supposed to kind of do that, but he's pushing the limit on some stuff and political stuff in like his previous press secretary not really having any White House briefings for like something like 92 days straight or something like that, which is daily. It makes it sound like you're running from the truth and you don't want to be asked the hard questions, and we'll find out in 2020 whether that actually will work.
Thinking then about 2020, so I suppose we've seen House proceedings step up a gear. I suppose there've been closed sessions in the House of Representatives and they're moving to a more public stance. Apparently John Bolton is also going to testify.
That's going to be fun.
We should get our popcorn out, I think, for
that. That's going to be great.
Who would have thought, like, a couple of years ago, that we'd be sat here kind of going, oh, I can't wait to hear John Bolton say anything or say something of interest, given 90% of the time previously it was, oh God, John Bolton has said something. Quick, try and defuse the situation as fast as possible.
It's going to be interesting because I think you get this a lot of one, John Bolton and a couple of the people that were around during Bush 2's one, which were, you look back at Bush and you're like, man, and I thought you were the worst thing ever when you were president, and you seem so much better than what Trump's going through. But I think there's a decent thing that you get with the people that were in Bush or moved on and continued on, and national security people in particular are, you'll see either national security people or defense people usually cross between Republicans and Democrats, because it is considered, there's a norm that it is apolitical, that your goal is to provide the best information and national security. So there's a sense of definitely statesmanship from them, and that to do the right thing if they feel it's the best thing for the country, which you may not find in other parts of the one. It's one of these kind of like, it's kind of like the Justice Department. Justice Department is supposed to be apolitical, but Trump has definitely made it much more political than I think people wanted it to ever be.
I'm going to forget or get wrong the name of the person who gave one of the most damning testimonies. Was it Bill Taylor, I think? Because he was, I think I'm right in saying, he worked in the Reagan administration, I think. So he was a career Republican administrator, essentially, a political appointment, I think, from Mike Pompeo. And it was he, I think, who had one of the more damning indictments of what was going on and the shenanigans around the quid pro quo, that kind of stuff.
It seems to be the impeachment has started to seem to tide in favor of kind of like, this, if nothing's done here, this could be bad for American democracy. But I also think the Democrats' suggestion to go for it, the way to go for it, strategy to go for it slow, is better, because if they had to vote on impeachment, which is what Trump wanted early on, he could say, look, they lost it. And now as they've kept it, more Republican House representatives have started to say, this is worth a look. This is much more worth a look than it was based on the one on stuff comes out. And I think the longer this drags on, the worse it ends up looking, because more stuff will end up coming out. And I think John Bolton's example is, I don't know if he would have possibly even said yes or picked a call up from Nancy Pelosi to come and testify like a month and a half ago. But I think the dam broke with Sondland's testimony, I think, kind of like put everything on the table and started to unravel. But I also think that Trump doubling down with China and continuing to say that there's no problems here, this is how you run ones, and proceeding to type his innocence or mash his innocence into his phone on Twitter probably didn't help for people that are died in the world Republicans, but are very much against abuse of power and, you know, that the president needs to be kept honest. And I think it's interesting to see John Bolton, but it's also interesting what happened. There must have been a fallout. Something must have been said or not said the right way or threat or something that made John Bolton come forward, because he is a solid Republican. It's very interesting to see that they were able to him even consider that he would want to speak in front of impeachment.
I wonder if there's a couple of things at play. I think one of them is that Trump never trusted John Bolton because of the mustache, which we are fans of, but I don't think Trump likes men with facial hair.
But I think that he sees them as part of the swamp, in his words, too. I think that he sees he's a different type of politician, that he brought his own people in, that also, if you look back when Trump started his presidential campaign for the Republican primary, he didn't get many of the top strategists in the Republican world. They went to Cruz, they went to Rubio, they went to Kasich. His advisors and the people that gave him a chance were towards the edge of the Republican strategist. And I also think he's not super trustworthy of people that had worked for other Republicans, because he probably couldn't trust them. And you've noticed that a lot of people that respect the Republicans don't end up staying long, because I think that there's an expectation from Trump, and this is to be said in the way my dad says it. He goes, if you're lived in New York and read the New York Post, which is one of our daily newspapers, he goes, you know what Trump's like. He's been on the paper for 20 years. And I think there's a decent amount of people that you know that Trump is, he wants 100% loyalty to him. That's who he's surrounded with his people. He's, I think a lot of people that ended up saying no to him and saying that he's not right don't end up staying one, because I don't think Trump cares for anybody going against him.
I think that's a really good point. I think the other thing is Trump doesn't really have much of a coherent ideology as well. And I think the other reason why maybe Bolton has parted company with Trump is the foreign policy aspect as well. So definitely decisions like withdrawing support for the Kurds, I think Bolton isn't down with. I'm trying to remember the catalyst now for Bolton leaving the White House in the first place, but I think, wasn't it about action with Iran?
Yes, if I remember correctly, it was related to him, Trump deciding not to sign the letter to continue the sanctions and a fight, and generally saying that we've made progress on this. We have something they're going to agree to. We have to keep it in one. And him basically saying that, Trump basically saying, no, they're not strong enough. They're still getting one. They're still one. And I think there's a lot of people that have worked at Middle Eastern politics will know and strategy that it is, they made progress finally for one time and one. Iraq was finally slowing down for them. They were able to one. Iran was finally coming to the table, and then just to blow up. And the fact that basically, I think it went on to basically, he didn't like it because Obama did it. That's generally the whole theory with Trump. Trump does not really care about foreign. And the only really foreign kind of relations that he cares about is stuff related to trade. Geopolitics never really interested him. It wasn't something that got him into why he wanted president. And I think the people he ended up surrounding himself with in terms of strategists pushed a much more far right. His people like Steve Bannon and all these people were on the edges of it and never really worked directly in places of power where these policies were won. And you could definitely see it in stuff like that. Trump has supported Hillary Clinton for her Senate race in 2006 in New York and contributed money. So keep that in mind when discussing Trump, is that he supported Democrats because they were good for his real estate interests inside of New York for like 20 some years prior to him deciding to be a Republican. Just keep that always in your back pocket.
Yeah. He's been on a journey, we could say. As you say, foreign policy isn't necessarily his thing. I suppose Trump in 2020 will run on his election, on his record in the economy, I think. And we read in prep for this, there's some interesting polling that Crooked Media, run by a lot of Obama staffers, did in Wisconsin. And they found that the thing that plays really well for Trump in these key swing states that will decide the White House under, as you say, your rather daft electoral college system, is Trump's record on the economy. Do you think there's a good way that Democrats can try and run against Trump? What do you think of what does it look like the line's going to be?
Yes, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So there's that saying, I think it's Bill Clinton said it, it's economy stupid. It's social issues, and as a member doing, social issues are easy to fix. Protecting abortion, these are easy to fix. Changing economic policy and shifting the paradigm of economics is not an easy thing, and it usually lasts out past your 4 years term, and it's generally it's painful and can be what I think that a lot of these voters in these Midwestern states and interior states is they see that NAFTA caused their factory to close and to lose their jobs. They see well-known American companies closing, and they see it as that we're not tough on China, we're not tough on Mexico and various different ones that were allowing them, we're making it easier for them to take American jobs. And I think that Trump's viewpoint on the tariffs, which I have a friend that actually works in Wisconsin, he lives in Madison, I went to high school with them, and he said they've already seen their revenue down 6% year over year due to the tariffs. And they make high-end kitchen appliances called Sub-Zero. And he said it's always changing about what is considered to be, that is going to be affected by tariff and what's not going to be affected by tariff. And he said, you know, those people think tough on China and tough on internal trade and protectionist is going to work well for him. It's just, it's the general one of, they saw the liberalization of NAFTA lose their jobs to Canada or leave jobs to ones. They see layoffs at many factories. They see made in China when they go to Walmart and stuff like that. But I generally think that his economic message is going to cut through that he's tough on what they see as the problem of why they don't have their jobs, other than, you know, decreased investment in infrastructure and higher taxes and they don't see the other side of it, of why, you know, the slow decline of manufacturing has happened in the US. Now, the thing that could change for Trump absolutely is whether we slide into a recession in manufacturing. And it's really, really likely that we're going to. Manufacturing is the last usually to slide into recession because of the durable goods. So you takes you 7 months to build a cat front loader, and these are expensive things that millions of dollars, and the durable goods, if the durable goods drops down, you're guaranteed to see possibly a recession. Now, but the manufacturing job numbers aren't as great as Trump wants to believe they are. The other thing that I think where impeachment does impact his message for his reelection is he can't sit there and talk about jobs. He's going to spend most of his time complaining about the impeachment one, and therefore he's going to be off his message of trade and how he strengthened the company and that I dropped your taxes and look, you have more money in your pocket. Job numbers are the best they've ever been. It pulls him off of his center one. Democrats can't compete against it. I think that Bernie Sanders, and I now in 2016 had a very good viewpoint of basically saying to the average American, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? Do you think that Trump's policies, or do you see that your life is going to get better anytime soon? If not, here's the reasons why. As a person that has student debt, I've been telling you the truth. Bernie Sanders understanding that student debt has decreased me taking a new job or moving to a new city because I have this chunk of money I have to pay every month is big for me. It's big for younger people. But I think he is beatable on healthcare and the cost of healthcare and bankruptcies and people not staying in their jobs. One, whether the economy he says is strong, does the average person see that the economy is strong? And I would tell you, probably most people don't believe that in these Midwest states. You know, I think Wisconsin is going to be a tough state for him for the Democratic nominee to win because it is pulled so red. Ohio's another one. Ohio's going to be really, really tough for Democrats to win. But a state like North Carolina and a state like Pennsylvania could be won by the Democrats. And I think like a Bernie Sanders economic justice kind of viewpoint of unions for all, you know, is better when we had one and places that have been hit hard by loss of jobs and their loss of and then loss of healthcare is going to play better. But I think it's winnable, the economy. But you also have to play this out why the current system is stacked against the average person. And I generally think that, you know, Bernie is doing a much better job. The question with Bernie and Warren is whether that is going to be able to cut through Trump's will be super nasty messaging on how they're socialists, because socialists and communism, after 60 years of telling you how the USSR and the Soviet Union was bad and China and one, whether his will cut through in these middle American states related to personal freedom and how they want to won, it might cut through for low information voters. I mean, it will be tough, but it's winnable. But on the other side of it, there's other states that are now more in play than they've ever been. Florida is much more in play now than it used to be. North Carolina is going to be another one. North booming economy in terms of biotech and quaternary ones, which are much more and generally more middle class, much more well educated, and that could absolutely change. But like Georgia was closer than most people want. Like, it will be very interesting to see. But I don't know if that is possible without a radical candidate on the Democratic side.
There's quite a lot to unpack there. Talking about Trump's personal corruption, from what the polling suggests in Illinois, looks like that's quite a good way to go. And also, I think Trump's personal hypocrisy. So they test the line that he ran as a populist, but then governs as a plutocrat and promised to try and take the US out of trade deals like NAFTA, and then really hasn't. Could be quite interesting.
Yeah, I think also the crooked media polling also suggested that the notion that Trump has completely failed to drain the swamp and has become a creature of the swamp in the eyes of a lot of voters is something that's got a lot of resonance as well.
I will give you an example. I will give you one. It's going to be the problem that Jeremy Corbyn's going to have in this upcoming election is he was new and he was great. And now he seems like just one of the rest. And that is going to, you know, the thing that helped Trump in 2016 It helps any challenger. He had no record. 2018 showed that the Democrats can win. Ended up flipping 40-some seats and huge numbers. 114 million people voted in 2018 midterm elections, the highest it's been in over 100 years. The Democratic Party now has a representative for each type of group. There's Union Dems, there's Labor Dems, there's Environmental Dems, there's Social Justice Dems, AOC, good example. And there's this real belief that from what happened in 2018, where people got there and they knocked on one, they ran races, they told their friends, they got engaged, and they were able to make real change, is very promising for the Democrats coming in 2020. The question really will be for Democrats is whether the enthusiasm in 2018 can be found among one candidate. Convincing people that the Democratic choice coming in 20 is better than Trump, why it needs to be voted in states where it's going to be 20, 30,000 votes, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Florida. I think there's a little optimism going into 2020 that wouldn't have happened had 2018 had not really brought in a fresh face as a bunch of minority congressmen, a bunch of women and stuff like that, that put a fresh face on a Democratic Party. The other thing that's positive, it's similar to what's kind of happening. It happened a couple of years ago, is Republican congressmen and some senators, one, are not running for re-election. And in the American system, that usually is predictive to a wave election. If people don't want the energy to fight their elections, feeling the chance that they're going to do a lot with a chance of losing, they will move on out of politics and into other most likely high paid lobbyist jobs if you're a Republican. The one thing the Democrats, I think, learned worked for them in 2016 is they're not having a super acrimonious. It is going to be down to energy. If the Democrats can absolutely get their base engaged and interested in donating money and making sure that they remember the vote and getting their friends registered to vote, it's likely to be a good chance. I found an article prior to it about that basically impeachment has made the Senate map for them in 2020 a lot more manageable than most people thought, because they have some really tough races. One, Doug Jones in Alabama, for example, is a really tough one. Most likely lean Republican state that's up. Joni Ernst in Iowa was saying that she's expecting a tough fight, which no one would have said that come 2 years ago. I don't know. What do you guys think about 2020? I want to know your feelings.
I think an awful lot of it really just depends on who the Democratic candidate actually ends up being. I think there's a couple of candidates who are on the more moderate end of the Democratic Party, which wouldn't necessarily be the particularly inspiring, and yet they're some of the main names being talked about. You've got Biden, and I'm going to murder the pronunciation of his surname here, Buttigieg.
Buttigieg.
I'm just going to call him Mayor Pete for ease. So Mayor Pete, Joe Biden, kind of both position themselves more in the moderate kind of, let's try and reach out more towards Republicans. And I'm not necessarily convinced that they're going to be able to inspire the kind of level of engagement that needs to happen for the Democrats to win.
I think the Democratic primary is going to be a really fascinating one to watch, because it feels like electability is the key thing that people are looking for. People are desperate to beat Trump. They want someone who they think will beat Trump. But I think the interesting thing is that you've got almost two diametrically opposed views to that. So you've got the Biden and the Buttigieg route, which is essentially to try and tack the centre, which I suppose is traditionally how it's happened. But I think there's a lot of people who are putting forward what you are saying, Patrick, essentially, which is that it's about mobilizing your voters and turning at your base, and the way to do that is with an inspiring positive message. I mean, it's similar to the debates that were happening in the Labour Party after 2015 in many ways, and I think even Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders is a very interesting mixture there, because just in terms of that whole approach, you know, Bernie seems very much more out and out, happy to call himself a socialist, whereas Elizabeth Warren rather call herself a capitalist. Warren's almost like somewhere halfway between Bernie and Biden, I think, trying to be a bit more pragmatic, but then also have real big structural change. And then you've also got people like Cory Booker or Amy Klobuchar who've got, on paper, I think, really, really quite sound candidates, but haven't quite caught fire yet. Oh, Kamala Harris as well. So it's going to be really, really interesting. I'm thinking maybe Elizabeth Warren at the moment, but it's really hard to tell. And especially, we probably won't know until Iowa, I suppose, in February, March.
Yeah, I think the only thing really that's I'd say is certain at the moment is possibly that Joe Biden's time has definitely been and gone, even though he's still obviously one of the major candidates in the race at the moment. A lot of his kind of momentum from the more moderate side of the party seems to have fallen behind Mayor Pete. And, as a result, that's kind of going to be impacting Biden moving forward. I mean, he's now basically had to shift to accepting super PAC money after basically saying he wouldn't do that. Kind of gives you an indication, I suspect, of how donations might be drying up for him a little bit.
Yes, Biden may not seem on paper or in one. At the end of the day, there's a certain select of people that vote in Democratic primaries that are considered establishment or party activists, because it's not a high turnout. And because those establishment ones know what Biden has done, and especially in the South, for example, they see the lesser of the evil in the person because he's been around there. They know him. And a lot of that is a lot of things that's going to play against Mayor Pete or America's mayor, depending on how you want various things, because the name is unknown. It's going to shake out, but it's going to be very interesting to see where certain bases of voters end up leaning towards in these primaries, but also where the attrition is to certain people. Your establishment Democrat is probably going to be who maybe isn't super connected, but, you know, votes in the primaries, everyone is a chance that could be most likely a Biden voter. Bernie has a huge grassroots one. So people that were excited about him in 2016, union members might end up being more favoring Biden. Educated women and educated and white educated Democrats in some of these states might end up finding Elizabeth Warren one. I don't think that Pete Buttigieg has much of a chance. I think that him, Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, Klobuchar, and the people that are polling in the low single digits are really looking for this as a place for them to get either a cabinet role or prepare for a future presidential run. I probably put Elizabeth Warren as your better chance of happening. There's something more fresh about Elizabeth Warren and the passion that Bernie kind of had in 2016 that she seems to be able to tap in. But Bernie has come stronger than ever back from his heart attack. There's been, generally speaking, a kind of uplift in Bernie ones. Biden's going to do okay in Iowa, but I imagine that even modest positions by Sanders and Warren are going to take a lot of the shine off of a Biden candidacy.
I think it'll be interesting to see how those different wings of the Democratic Party, as you say, the more educated voters, the ones who are more casual but maybe going off name recognition, the union voters, maybe starting to coalesce around different candidates as well. Listen, Patrick, it's 5 to 11 here, so, and we've got lots of doors to knock in the election tomorrow. So we're going to probably draw it to a close, but it'd be great to check in maybe in 2 or 3 weeks and see if Trump's been impeached and see what the state of the race is.
And I'd love to do one with British politics to talk about it.
Let's do that. Well, we've got quite an interesting one, actually. Yeah. Kind of like an outsider perspective of...
Yeah, see if you can catch some of the TV debates and then we could have a catch up after that. That could be interesting. Where can people find you on Twitter, Patrick?
I am pcook11 on Twitter. Shoot me a message. I will answer any questions you have about American politics.
Thank you again, Patrick. Our website is notenoughchampagne.com. Our Twitter handle is @nochampagnepod. And we have a Facebook page, which is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. James Cram designed our logo. You can follow him on Twitter @JamesCram. And Dave Depp is responsible for our theme tune, Plucky Good Times. I'm @PaperbackWriter.
I'm @AcousticRadical.
Happy plotting.